Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With the criminally disgraced media baron Rupert Murdoch threatening to buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, we'll begin with an analysis of the media landscape from former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, the only dissenting voice on the FCC who opposed recent media mega mergers. We'll discuss his article at The Nation, The New Telecom Oligarchs, and what citizens can do to hold on to the electronic commons and the free flow of information on the internet. Then we'll speak with Peter Barnes, an entrepreneur and writer who started several successful businesses, including Working Assets, now Credo. He is the editor of a new book which the late Jonathan Rowe wrote, Our Commonwealth, The Hidden Economy That Makes Everything Else Work. And we will discuss the endangered commons, the air, water, wildlife, and wilderness that are being increasingly corporatized and commodified, and explore ways citizens can hold on to what we have left and create a balance between the commons and profit-driven capitalism. Then finally, we will look further into the so-called Monsanto Protection Act, a rider in a must-pass continuing resolution that exempted the agricultural giant and manufacturer of Agent Orange from liability and lawsuits. Stephen Schwartz, a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute, joins us. He has an article at Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, The Great Experiment, Genetically Modified Organisms, Scientific Integrity, and National Wellness. And we will discuss the suppression of research on lab rats fed with GMO grain that has resulted in tumors and infertility. And joining us now is Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. He has an article at The Nation, The New Telecom Oligarchs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Copps.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And over the last weekend, you were in Denver attending a conference organized by Free Press, a two-day national conference on media reform. So reading your article at The Nation on the new telecom oligarchs, give us a sense of how the playing field is in terms of those who want to capture and control our media and those who want to free it up for the public.
Well, I think for those who want to capture and control, the playing field is looking pretty good right now. We continue with the monopolization of our media, the monopolization of our news and information infrastructure, the monopolization of our access to broadband, and I think we're all beginning to see now the possibility of that, what we thought was going to be forever open and dynamic technology, the internet and new media, starting to head down that road toward consolidation too. So those of us who consider ourselves reformers and consider this situation unacceptable to a small d, a democratic country, have been warning about this for a while. What I brought out of Denver in the Media Reform Conference, in addition to the coast-to-coast traveling that I've done over the past few months, is that we seem to be almost at something of a tipping point, a good tipping point, because I think people are beginning now to see the fruits of what reformers were talking about for a long time. Not just high cable rates in traditional media, but gatekeeping and denials of the open internet, inelegantly named network neutrality, the fights over can we unlock our handsets and all this. People are getting to see that this translates from theories of reformers into practicalities in the marketplace, and it comes into their own house and affects their own lives. So there was almost, there's a growing, and I think it's already somewhat palpable or tangible change in that direction. So I want us to I'm trying to mobilize a national dialogue on this, and I think it's beginning to form. We're trying to bring some higher level of concern in the White House about all of these issues as the president gets ready to designate a new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, because this one is leaving. And what we would like that new chairperson to do, chairman or chairwoman, maybe, would be really to redeem some of the pledges that candidate Obama made back when he was running back in 2007, 2008. I had letters in my file as an FCC commissioner from Senator Obama, candidate Obama, saying we shouldn't be loosening media ownership rules, for example, and letting a few moguls buy up more and more properties, without understanding how this affects minorities and diversity audiences. We should have, he said, a proceeding about the public interest at the FCC. We should reassert the public interest. So I know they've been pretty busy over this first term with a lot of issues. This one didn't get the attention I thought it deserves. I'm hoping maybe we can change his mind now, but the best thing to change a president's mind, or at least confirm confirm him in the determination to do what he said he'd do in the first place, is some pressure from the grassroots.
Well, Michael Copps, I'm speaking to you from directly across the street from Universal Studios in Los Angeles, of course, and people in Los Angeles, a considerable part of the population, is quite concerned at the possibility of the only newspaper we have here, the Los Angeles Times, being bought by Rupert Murdoch, and he's indicated that he's hoping that somebody more favorable to his point of view will replace the outgoing head of the FCC, Janikowski, who left, who you just mentioned, waiting to see who Obama will appoint. So what would your recommendation to the people in Los Angeles who don't want Rupert Murdoch controlling two television stations already in Los Angeles and then controlling the major newspaper?
Well, isn't it interesting, first of all, that you're talking to me from Los Angeles and you're finding me today in Chicago, and both cities are wondering if Rupert Murdoch is coming their way and going to be controlling their newspapers. The same fellow who owns lots of other outlets, as you were just saying. What should people in Los Angeles be doing is to really be expressing to their decision makers how they think the present media landscape is serving their purposes. Do they feel that they're getting what they need? You know, there was a Pew Research study out just last week, I think it was. A third of the people, according to that, responding to that survey, said they are tuning out the local news, the nightly news in their localities, because they're not getting the kind of news and information that they want and that they're looking for. So if that's the way people feel, and I've seen that frustration around the country for the last 12 years that I've been doing this now, both within and now after the commission, let's make that known. That's how reform happens in this country. It doesn't come as a gift from legislators in Washington all tied up in a nice package with a pretty ribbon. It comes because people in the hustings demand systemic reform. That's how we've always gotten big reform. Civil rights, worker rights, the list goes on and on. That's how we get media rights, too.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Copps, who was the FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. He has an article at The Nation, The New Telecom Oligarchs. So I'm wondering, in many ways, the healthcare debate has been hamstrung by the fact that the American people don't know how badly off they are compared to the rest of the world in terms of how much they spend for healthcare and what kind of services they get. Even though right next door in Canada, there's a perfectly good system that's being demonized over here. And it seems to the same is true in the media. In France, for example, their broadband providers and internet providers, I think it's about a quarter of the cost, and you get infinitely more bandwidth and higher speed. The same is true in South Korea. And these monopolies who control our cable access and package their products, which they heavily advertise, are giving really appallingly bad service compared to the rest of the countries in the world. And in fact, if you look at a little area down there in Tennessee, at Chattanooga, they happen to have broadband as a local utility. And they've got the fastest high-speed broadband in the country that they're offering their customers. So what's gone wrong here, and how much have you seen this on the inside, and how did it happen, in effect, that we, the country that invented the internet, should slip further and further behind in internet provision?
Yeah, well, when I went to the FCC in 2001, we were probably number one or two in the world. By the time I left, I don't think I had anything to do with this. I hope not. We were number, depending upon whose rankings you looked at, 15th or 20th or 24th. But let's take a specific example. You mentioned Chattanooga. They did build out municipal broadband and treat it as a utility. But the special interests have gone, in the last few years, into 19 states and had laws passed at the state level precluding or making almost impossible the ability of municipalities to build out their own broadband, because Comcast or Verizon or AT&T They'll want them to do it. And these are places where Comcast and AT&T and Verizon have no intention of going, and they're frank to admit that. But they don't want anybody else going there, too. So we've got Chattanooga, we've got Lafayette, Louisiana, we've got Wilson, North Carolina. You've got about 100 examples of places around the country that have built out very successfully, in many cases, their own municipal broadband. But now that's going to be that much more difficult. How did they get away with it? Because the news wasn't covered, because there's no state house reporting anymore. Nobody's holding the powerful accountable. Same thing in Washington, D.C. The last time I looked, there were like 26 or 27 states that did not have an accredited reporter on Capitol Hill. Well, how in the world do you hold the powerful accountable in a situation like that, where all these stories go unreported and go even unknown? So how did it happen? I think it happened, and this began long before the rise of the Internet. It happened because of all of this consolidation we've had in both media and telecommunications, and because we had a public agency, government, the Federal Communications Commission, that really was derelict in its duty to the public interest. So they took all of this new broadband technology and everything, and let me back up a minute. The Telecommunications Act says every citizen in the United States should have reasonably comparable services at reasonably comparable prices and the most advanced services possible. Beginning in 2001, the FCC said, well, let's not call broadband telecommunications. So they put it in a different part of that statute where there were no consumer protections or privacy protections or public safety provisions. We're the only country in the world that went through a linguistic exercise like that. We're going to call it an information technology instead of telecommunications. That really hobbled its deployment and hobbled its adoption. The only country in the world. We also have a Federal Communications Commission that seldom meets a merger or acquisition that it doesn't like. Now, thank God it finally got us act together and indicated thumbs down on the AT&T and the T-Mobile merger, but that was such a no-brainer. But the year or so before that, right across the street from where you are now, Universal Studios, the FCC approved that NBC Universal Comcast merger, which was one of the most far-reaching mergers in history because it's new media, it's old media, it's content, it's distribution, it's vertical control, horizontal control. It's the whole nine yards. And the vote went through 4-1. You might have guessed that I was probably the one vote against, and indeed I was, because that conferred so much power, so much influence on one company that is just inimical, I think, to the needs of a small-D democratic society.
Well, Michael Kopsch, in your Nation article, The New Telecom Oligarchs, you say that for 8 years I had been in the Democratic minority at the FCC, unable to rein in the enthusiasm of my GOP colleagues for even more media industry consolidation. But wasn't that supposed to change after the 2008 election?
You bet it was. And I thought, whoopee, our time has come for a consumer protection agency. And lo and behold, now we're 4 years, almost 4.5 years down the pike, and the commission is still blessing mergers. It's still in the process of eliminating public interest protections. Now, I think that, let me be fair and square, with my former colleagues, I think that the chairman has done good things in lots of areas, broadband and having a strategy rather than that let the market do it all approach that we had for the previous 8 years. But it hasn't lived up to the expectations I had. And if you had told me 4.5 years ago that the commission would be dealing right now with the new chairman's proposals to loosen media ownership, the current chairman's proposal to weaken the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership that we talked about here with regard to the Tribune and all, I wouldn't have believed you, but I would have been wrong.
Well, but the irony is that under the previous chairman, Michael Powell, who was really laissez-faire, all of his actions were done in the name of competition and free market competition. That's the ideology. But the result is the opposite of that ideology. What you end up with are these big sclerotic monopolies like AT&T. I had to give up my AT&T phone. I couldn't even get calls at my own home. the service was so bad, but yet they spend tons and tons of money on lobbyists and advertising telling us how they you can have a television that you can move around the house. So that's – meanwhile, they won't invest in cell towers. So I don't understand how – I guess it goes back to the fact that we don't know how badly we're getting shafted. Is that what's happening?
Well, I think that's a large part of it. Competition may be the mantra. Competition may be the rhetoric, but it's a special interest behind it. And right now, we have the big telephone combine proposing to the Federal Communications Commission that as we transition from plain old telephone service to Internet protocol technology, that they get out totally, almost totally, from any kind of public policy oversight whatsoever. So the end result of that is monopoly without any regulation. Now, we've had periods in this country when we had monopolies and Ma Bell and all of that, but we still had some public policy oversight. Now they're going for the whole nine yards. Get any policy requirements, public policy oversight out of here, release us from all of those, and let the good times roll, and let's continue on with the monopolization of telecommunications and media markets across the country. And that's exactly what it is in many areas, monopoly. Once in a while, you get a duopoly. You're really lucky a triopoly, but you seldom do any better than that. The competition is ridiculous. A lot of the European countries have competitive policies or other countries around the world where competitors have access to the basic infrastructure. They pay for it, but they have access, and they can offer their own different plans and all that. We did away with that, and I lived through that proposal day by day at the Federal Communications for years, and competition was dealt really a serious blow from which, unless we change direction, it ain't about to recover from.
Well, just in closing, Michael Kopps, you mentioned the inelegant term net neutrality, which certainly doesn't do justice to what's at stake there in the sense that the Internet is in many ways the last sort of bastion of free communication. It plays an extraordinarily important part in Russia, where Putin has taken over all the press but the Internet, and equally true in China. It may be what brings about Chinese democracy, and it may well be what saves Russian democracy. But here in the United States, there is a threat to corporatize it and to fast-track corporate content and to slow-track what people want in terms of what they're used to, and to do away with the electronic commons, which is really why I think the Internet has become so important and so ubiquitous. So where do we stand in that fight?
Well, the tragedy of it all is that you have this open and dynamic and opportunity-creating technology, perhaps the greatest one the world has ever seen since the invention of the printing press, maybe more so than that. So we should be using that tool, and it should be open and accessible and available to all. And we see the toll booths going up. We see the gatekeepers going up. We see data plans and rationing and this, and you can't get broadband access, and one case after another. What a tragedy it would be if the outcome, 20, 30 years after the invention of the Internet, however long it's been, what a tragedy would be if the end result of that would end up being a cableized Internet. If it was just another cable system and consumers were paying exorbitant rates and everybody didn't have access, we have to have some kind of a dialogue in this country about what are we going to do to ensure that that Internet is serving the public interest. And that doesn't mean regulating. I get so annoyed when people say, oh, you want to regulate the Internet. What we want to do is put consumers in control of their own Internet experience rather than having big companies in control of their Internet experience. What we want to do is have models on that Internet for the production of news and investigative journalism. We've lost so much of that in traditional media, but we don't have a model for it in new media. And meanwhile, the civic dialogue is kind of hemorrhaging, and issues are not being teed up that we need to be teeing up if we're going to dig ourselves out of the hole that America's dug itself into over the past 10 or 15 years or so. So it's a huge, huge question. And I think it ought to be on everybody's radar right up near the top of their list, this future of the media ecosystem. Because I don't care what issue you're interested in, that issue is not going to go anywhere until the public, who eventually will decide that issue, has the basis to make an intelligent decision. It might go somewhere. It might go the wrong way. But it's not going to go in productive ways unless people understand what issues are, unless they're analyzed, unless we replace glitzy infotainment with real news, unless we replace spin with substance, unless we replace opinion with facts. That's the need of the hour right now regarding any problem that we confront in this country. And that's why anybody listening to this show ought to get really serious about the future of our media and let their representatives and powers that be and anybody else know of their opinion and know of their determination to have a news and information infrastructure and a telecommunications infrastructure that serves their needs.
Well, Michael Copps, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Happy to be on. Thanks for covering these issues.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. He has an article at The Nation, The New Telecom Oligarchs. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about our commonwealth, the hidden economy that makes everything else work.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went along.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Barnes, who's an entrepreneur and writer who started several successful businesses, including Working Assets, now Credo. He has written for Newsweek, The New Republic, and numerous other magazines, and is the author of five books, including Who Owns the Sky and Capitalism 3.0. He co-founded On the Commons with Jonathan Rowe and is the editor of Jonathan Rowe's new book, Our Commonwealth, The Hidden Economy That Makes Everything Else Work. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Barnes.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be here.
And we were just speaking with Michael Copps, the former FCC commissioner, the lone voice that voted against many of these big mega mergers in terms of corporate ownership of the media and in terms of, in fact, you know, fewer and fewer and more and more powerful corporations owning more and more of the media and information spectrum. And he was quite passionate about the great battle for net neutrality to preserve the last of the commons, if you will, the electronic commons. And I see from your new book that you edited, Our Commonwealth, The Hidden Economy That Makes Everything Else Work, that you see this equally as an important, if not vital, frontier that we need to hold on to.
Absolutely. The book that I edited by my late friend Jonathan Rowe is called Our Commonwealth, and it talks about a lot of things that we don't notice or even think about as being ours, part of a commons that belongs to everybody, but certainly the airwaves and the internet are two of the most important commons out there, and both are under constant threat, as are all aspects of the commons, are under constant threat of being privatized in one way or another. And Michael Copps is certainly right about the internet being under threat from all sorts of big corporations. And the same is true for the airwaves, which now increasingly, because of our mobile phones and Wi-Fi and so forth, are an absolutely critical asset to keep in the commons. Not only to keep, but to expand the, for example, the availability of free internet access via the airwaves. Free universal Wi-Fi would be a great leap forward, so we wouldn't have to pay cable companies and phone companies to do all the things we now do. That's one thing that Jonathan Rowe talks about in this book, Our Commonwealth, is how some cities in America, including Philadelphia and others, are going down this path of creating municipal Wi-Fi systems, which would be available to residents in the city for free. So more of that plus net neutrality on the Internet would be really important things to fight for.
Well, Peter Barnes, Michael Copps mentioned, of course, when I brought up the city of Chattanooga that has the best and fastest Internet in the United States in terms of broadband, and it's a public utility in the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and he mentioned that there are a number of other municipalities that have this, but what's happened is the big corporations like AT&T and Verizon and Warner, they're apparently, through their influence over state legislatures, are preemptively passing laws that prevent municipalities from doing this to provide that kind of service to their consumers and customers. And so there you have it. This is a battle. And the corporations are much more aggressive, I'm afraid, than we are in terms of pushback.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the problem more broadly, that you've got powerful private profit-maximizing corporations who are just all over the place trying to expand into every nook and cranny that they can. And yet, on the other side, the side of the commons, there's very little organized defense, much less offense. So this is a real problem. Speaking of the FCC, though, the chairman, who I believe just resigned, Julius Genachowski, before he left, he did put out a proposal for there's all this spectrum, broadcast spectrum, that was given away about 10 years ago to the TV companies so that they could convert from analog to digital. But now they have excess spectrum that they can't use or are not using, and the FCC wants to get that back and make it available for public Wi-Fi. So whether this is going to happen or not, who knows? It's going to be another one of those all-out battles against, you know, corporations versus the people. But if it did happen, it would be a major breakthrough.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Barnes, who's an entrepreneur and writer who started several successful businesses, including Working Assets, now Credo. He has written for Newsweek, The New Republic, and numerous other magazines, and is the author of five books, including Who Owns the Sky and Capitalism 3.0. He co-founded On the Commons with Jonathan Rowe and is the editor of the late Jonathan Rowe's new book, Our Commonwealth, The Hidden Economy That Makes Everything Else Work. Now, clearly, the issues that you bring up in the book came to light, particularly in the last election, when the dichotomy between makers and takers was brought up by Mitt Romney, who was recorded surreptitiously. And then, of course, later in the campaign, the president mentioned rather innocuously, actually, that the wealthy in this country, who have basically had a pretty good deal for the last several decades, they're not responsible for everything. They didn't make everything. And he was talking about roads and infrastructure that have enabled them to operate and become wealthy. And, of course, that was seized upon by somebody who's actually, in a way, the worst example of capitalism, an asset stripper, Mitt Romney. So where do you think we stand in terms of that argument, in terms of the public consciousness? I mean, clearly Obama won.
Yeah, Obama won. I don't think that argument has great resonance with the public, obviously, but it is a constant refrain that you hear from rich people, that they earned their wealth through hard work and being smarter than everybody else, and if you didn't make a lot of money, that just means you're lazy and stupid. Of course, that is absurd. Most people who are wealthy, you know, I'm not arguing that they didn't work, but what I'm saying is that the wealth that they have accumulated comes not so much from their work, but from a whole array of gifts from society and from nature that they had absolutely nothing to do with creating. Bill Gates, you know, if you want to start with, like, the richest man in the world, or maybe now he's just the second richest. But if you really look at Microsoft and try to figure out where their wealth comes from, it isn't from any great genius in writing software. It's, first of all, from the copyright protection that they get for free from the U.S. government. Secondly, it's from monopoly power in a couple of important markets. Third, it's from the when any company, including Microsoft, goes public, the value of the stock goes up by some multiple, not because of anything the company did, but just because of liquidity, which is a socially created value. Anyway, you could go on, and when you dissect the fortunes of just about any of these rich people, well over half, you know, you could probably argue three-quarters of it, is essentially a taking from the public. And this they don't talk about. So if we could reclaim, we the people could reclaim some of the wealth that really rightfully belongs to all of us, we would have a much more equitable distribution of wealth and income in our country.
Well, Peter Barnes, not only is corporate capitalism incompatible with the biosphere in terms of what we're seeing with the effects of global warming, because it's based upon growth and consumption, and the biosphere simply, and Mother Nature is telling us enough already. And the other aspect, I think, is that, you know, even a reactionary like Henry Ford realized you had to pay your workers enough money to buy your product. And this financialization of American capitalism with the growing power of Wall Street has led to a capitalism of extracting wealth but not creating wealth, as the robber barons did. This has led to, for example, the millennial generation now, through the ownership that the powerful and the oligarchy, if you will, have over our politics, where they're able to buy the Congress, in effect. There have been some pernicious laws passed, particularly with for-profit education, student loans, which is now second only to household mortgage debt. Students simply cannot be forgiven for these loans. And you have this phenomenon where this whole generation are being indentured, many of them ending up with worthless diplomas with no job prospects. And that's never happened before. And speaking as a father of a millennial, fortunately, she went to medical school and just graduated. But a lot of her friends simply, you know, living with their parents and looking at a pretty bleak future.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm the father of a millennial as well. It's tragic. It's horrible. And there's no way out that's in sight. But, you know, this does go back to the question of the commons, because the only way we're going to preserve a large middle class in America, which is what we're talking about here, is through, it's not going to be just through jobs, because there are never going to be a large supply of middle-class jobs in America, again, for a variety of reasons, globalization, mechanization, automation, and so on. So that period we had after World War II, when there were a lot of high-paying union jobs, which was how the middle class was built in this country, plus the GI Bill and free education and things like that, those days are over. The only way going forward that we can sustain a large middle class in this country is through sharing wealth and giving everybody non-labor income that comes from the wealth that we actually do share. And one way to do that, for example, which would simultaneously deal with the climate change problem that you mentioned, is to put a cap on carbon emissions, make the polluters pay, and take that revenue from pollution and distribute it equally to every American, one person, one share. Similar to what they do in Alaska with the oil revenue, but this would be done with polluters paying, which they now do not do. So everybody would get an income stream from the commons, if you will, because the air is part of the commons. And this income stream could grow over time with other sources of revenue from the commons. And that would supplement what people earn through labor. So some kind of combination of labor income plus income from the commons, I think that's probably the only way going forward that we can keep a middle class in America.
And, of course, the prerequisite will be for more political involvement, because you've got to take back the government from the oligarchs.
That is the fundamental prerequisite in all of this. We really need to have a movement that has enough power to fight successfully against the corporations and the oligarchs, as you call them.
Well, Peter Barnes, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Barnes, who's an entrepreneur and writer who started several successful businesses, including Working Assets, now Credo. He has written for Newsweek, The New Republic, and numerous other magazines, and is the author of 5 books, including Who Owns the Sky and Capitalism 3.0. He co-founded On the Commons with Jonathan Rowe and is the editor of the late Jonathan Rowe's new book, Our Commonwealth, The Hidden Economy That Makes Everything Else Work. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Monsanto is using its muscle to suppress research on lab rats fed with GMO grains.
Tomatoes. They'll beat you, bash you, squish you, mash you, chew you up for brunch, and finish you off for dinner or lunch. They're marching down the halls. They're crawling up the walls.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratory for Fundamental Research. He is also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and he has an article at Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, The Great Experiment, Genetically Modified Organisms, Scientific Integrity, and National Wellness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Welcome to you. Nice to talk to you again, Ian.
And recently I did an interview about what is being derisively called the Monsanto Protection Act, which was a rider that was inserted into a must-pass spending bill recently by Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, which is the home state for Monsanto. And it basically protects Monsanto from any federal lawsuit and instructs the Department of Agriculture to ignore lawsuits against people who are concerned about genetically engineered crops. So you've looked into some of the research to do with animals that have been fed by GMO foods, lab animals, and these studies on the surface are extremely alarming, but they've created a kind of battle within the scientific community. So is there a pattern here? The fact that Monsanto has the political clout to essentially be above the law and to get a senator to put a bill in that makes them immune from any prosecution and essentially puts them above the judicial branch of government. Is that also happening in terms of their clout in the research community?
Well, I mean, yes. Let's just pause for a second, Ian, and say this is quite extraordinary that we're involved in what amounts to a huge laboratory animal experiment, and we're the animals. If you think about this for a second, you've got a law in which they've done something which it's very unclear what the long-term effects are going to be, but should they be terrible, you have no recourse. I cannot believe that that will stand, but that is a measure of the corruption of the American government by large corporate interests. I mean, Blunt is not only did it, he's proud of having done it. It's part of a much larger trend which is going on all over the world, actually, that deals with the commodification of the food system, because that's really what we're talking about. I mean, the GMO part is part of it, but the deeper thing that's going on, which people just don't seem to have any true awareness of, is that the entire food system of the world is being taken over by a few companies. Just to give you a couple of examples, 4 corporations control 66% of the pork packing market in the United States. 4 control 58% of poultry. 4 control 84% of the beef market. 3 companies control 90% of the global grain trade. And 4 companies own 48% of all the grocery retailers. So what you have is an extraordinary concentration of power in a tiny number of corporates, interests, who routinely, thanks to Citizens United, have the ability to influence government policy. This latest thing with the Monsanto Protection Act that Blunt sponsored is just one of the more egregious, but by no means the only example of this complete corruption of the world's food system and turning it into a commodity process to enrich a small group at the risk of the health of the many.
Well, of course, the good news is that it's a rider to a continuing spending resolution, which expires in 6 months, so that there's a chance for citizens to get aroused. But at the heart of this issue is whether or not this giant corporation, Monsanto, which, after all, was the manufacturer of Agent Orange that caused so many problems in Vietnam, the defoliant, and with the American vets. And now, of course, they're advertising themselves as being committed to sustainable agriculture, committed to the farmer. Their website claims that the company helps farmers be successful and produce healthier food while also reducing agriculture's impact on our environment. Now, that's nothing new. Oil companies tell us how much they care about the environment, and we saw what happened with BP in the Gulf. And now they've
Or Arkansas.
Right, but and since then they keep telling us how much they've cleaned up the Gulf and how everything's great. So, corporate propaganda aside, what is going on here with GMOs and their risk to consumers who eat GMO food, based upon research with rats? That's, I think, really where the rubber meets the road in this issue.
Well, I think you are correct. The latest controversy that has arisen occurred as a result of work done by a French molecular biologist, Giles-Eric Seralini, who's a professor and departmental chair of molecular biology at the University of Caen in France, and who heads the research team for the French National Center for Scientific Research and the National Institute for Agriculture Research. And he published a paper which included some pictures, which I think it was the pictures that really did it, showing these tumorous rats who were fed GMO foods. And he was attacked, and there's lots of to-ing and fro-ing. And at one level, it looks like, well, the study may not have been as good as it should have been. But, you know, in the world of nutrition genetics, nothing is ever quite what it seems. You have to go back to who did the research and who paid for the research. And as it turns out, Seralini is just one of a growing number of scientists. This has become such a big war between the corporate-funded scientists and university or the non-corporate funded scientists, that the Independent Science News got a letter that was signed by a long list of scientists who were very concerned about even threats of physical violence. For instance, Andreas Carresco, who's a professor of molecular embryology at the University of Buenos Aires, who identified the risks of one of the active ingredients in Roundup and its effects. And 26 of these scientists wrote because they were concerned about not just scientific pressure, but literally physical threats that they felt for publishing research which did not accord with the corporate interests. And if you look around the world, I mean, you could, for instance, Alexei Surov, who headed a Russian team, did a study in which he fed GMOs to a species of hamster called Campbell hamsters. He fed them on Monsanto GM soy for 2 years across three generations. And what he discovered was all sorts of strange pathologies began developing in these rats. For instance, they began having hair grow on the inside of their mouths. And the key thing was they became infertile. And this is one of the constants that you see across all of this research. What's happened, I think, is that, you know, we're early days in GMO research and genetic manipulation. And initially, researchers thought these things were not straightforward exactly, but fairly linear. And what we're discovering as time has gone on, and there are several levels of this, is that these when you cause these genetic changes, that it sets in motion not just the linear difference that you're trying to achieve, but a whole set of unintended interactions that produce all sorts of things. I mean, Austrian researchers reported that fourth-generation Monsanto GMO corn-fed mice became completely infertile, and that the offspring of the mother rats fed the GMO soy within 3 weeks were smaller than the non-GMO-fed rats. But that's one aspect. Then there's a whole other aspect, and that's the idea that many of the assumptions that the use of GMO crops were originally based on, which was they were going to be resistant to various kinds of pests and things that attack them, insects of one kind or another, that has proven not to be true. There was just a publication in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences coming out of the University of Arizona that specifically found that the widely used idea of putting these two or more toxins sort of for redundant killing, the idea being that these crops would kill not one but several pests, that what actually happens is that the pests, they don't all get killed off, and they mutate, and then they become resistant. So these things become more and more toxic, but the insects and other pests that prey upon them become more and more horrific. Sort of we're the unintended consequence is to create kind of monster pests and predators. And the net of this is that we are conducting what amounts, at least based on the evidence. Now, again, I am entirely an evidence-based person. So based on the evidence, it would appear that we have engaged in a huge worldwide animal experiment in which human beings are the lab rats. And it's not at all clear, at this stage anyway, what the long-term consequences of ingesting GM grains and animals that have been manipulated genetically, what the long-term effects of that is going to be. And now with this Monsanto Protection Act that Senator Blunt has sponsored, which Monsanto apparently wrote, what they're trying to do is to relieve themselves of having any responsibility for the outcome of these experiments. It's just, I just find it appalling. I applaud the research at one level because ultimately it may do wonderful things for us, but I don't think it's quite ready for prime time. And the idea that people, that it's going to be commercialized anyway and that people are then going to be subjected to who knows what and have no recourse is, I mean, it's really quite monstrous, both ethically and just as a question of national wellness.
Well, we saw that play out here in the state of California with Proposition 37 in the last ballot, which was a GMO labeling proposition that meant foods with GMO that were made with GMO seeds and were genetically manipulated in any way would have to be labeled, which seems reasonable. And the big companies like Monsanto spent enormous amount of money. It was initially very popular with substantial majorities were for Prop 37, but by the time they had spent all this money on television advertising saying with the so-called scientists and authority figures saying this was a bad idea. Actually, they're mostly arguing that it was going to cost more at the supermarket. It failed. So that would seem to be, you know, I don't understand why if there are some questions about the consequences of GMO genetically altered food products, why it would be wrong to label them and give the consumer the choice until we find out whether or not they're harmful.
Well, I mean, here's the question. I mean, ask yourself this. If they think that GMOs are so great, why don't they want to label them? I mean, people are dying to label their products organic because they know that if they label it organic, it's going to sell better. You would think if this stuff was so great that the companies that produce these GMO products would be all too happy to have them labeled because it would be a marketing plus. The fact that they have gone to enormous length, and yes, Prop 37 is an example of the level of corruption we're talking about. It started out with above 90% approval rating, and by pouring in millions and millions of dollars, they were able basically to buy a proposition outcome. And the idea is to obfuscate and make secret what they're doing. That's the real issue. If it's such a great idea, why don't they want it to be transparent and everybody to know about it? And the answer is that they don't know that it's great. They really don't know because nobody knows what the long-term consequences of this is going to be. And they are willing to go to extraordinary lengths to suppress this. Let me just take a second to say, tell you one story. This is about a man named Arpad Puste, who is a biologist at the Rowett Institute in Aberdeen, Scotland, which is the top nutritional research lab in the United Kingdom. And he'd been working there for 35 years, right? He first published his first paper in this field in 1961. He'd been publishing ever since. He'd published 300 peer-reviewed papers, and he also wrote 12 books. So this is a guy who was one of the international authorities. And in the early 90s, he got a $3 million grant from the British government to design a system for safety testing genetically modified organisms. Perfectly reasonable. And that the idea was that he would establish testing protocols that could be used throughout the European market. And he had 20 scientists from three other facilities working with him. This was a major push to try to set up standards that would establish what was safe in genetically modified organisms. Very straightforward, reasonable, appropriate, safe regulation. And he felt very strongly about it. He was the perfect guy to do this. So in 2002, he put out a paper. It said, "Can science give us the tools for recognizing this health?" And nearly 10 years after introducing these foodstuffs, there were only still a handful of papers. So he developed a protocol for feeding GMO potatoes to rats. Very straightforward. And the potatoes had been modified to produce a chemical called lecithin, and the idea was to discourage pests from attacking the potatoes. And so he fed regular potatoes to some of the rats, and he fed these genetically modified potatoes to other rats. Very straightforward stuff. Within 10 days, the animals develop potentially precancerous cell growth, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partially atrophied livers, and damaged immune systems. And that was just a part of it. And so he published this, let this be known, and he got a request from an interview, and following his institute's, which is very standard, protocol about media contacts, he went to his institute and the ROIT and said, you know, I've been asked to do this media interview, and can I do it? And they said, okay, yes, you can do it. And the interview was released in August of 1998, and he was hailed as a hero by his institute and other genetic scientists. And then Tony Blair's office, who was a pro-GM prime minister, Tony Blair's office called up, and the next morning he was fired. He was silenced with threats of a lawsuit. His team was dismantled. The protocols were never implemented. His institute and the UK government together launched a smear campaign to destroy his reputation. It took an act of Parliament to lift the gag order against him, and eventually he got the study published in The Lancet. So this was a man whose life work was destroyed because he had the temerity to come forward and say, we need to test GMO foods, and here is a protocol for doing it, and when I did it, I got these results. That is an extraordinary example of the level of scientific warfare that is going on to protect what amounts to billions of dollars of sales of a product whose long-range implications we do not understand.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Schwartz, I understand that Russian researchers from the National Association of Genetic Safety are going to put online a live study with web cameras of cages of rats that are being fed GMO food, and they're going to be broadcast live around the world, available 24/7 on the internet. So we will look forward to that, and I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute, and he is also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and he has an article at Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, The Great Experiment, Genetically Modified Organisms, Scientific Integrity, and National Wellness. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Rarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.